My guest today is my brother Brendan, and even to say that, you know, to actually think that you're going to have the type of conversation that we're going to have with the person you grew up. Brendan is Brendan Schwab. He's 4.5 years younger than me, and which made when we were growing up for an ideal combination as probably as big an influence on my life growing up was actually comic books as it was sport, and so made ideal for a Batman and Robin combination. And so he was the Robin to my Batman, but I think I'm probably the Robin to his Batman now as we've grown up, and his achievements are quite extraordinary. And it was interesting, even in asking him to come on the podcast, is almost took a little bit of convincing, because he understands the work I do is with leaders and leadership, and perhaps doesn't quite see himself in that context where clearly under any definition he's led in such a way that he's created and played a massive role in the development and evolution of football, soccer in Australia, particularly in regard to the Matildas. But he's also in a human rights, his leadership in human rights has perhaps led to people's lives being saved. I think you'll find this conversation will take you into all sorts of unexpected places. It was indeed a pleasure from my point of view. I'm unbelievably proud of what he's been able to do, and almost been able to sit and watch it evolve. And even in the course of this conversation, I almost found myself just watching it all evolve in front of me, and I'm sure you will as well. Thank you. Okay, I'm here with my brother Brendan Schwab, and someone I'm particularly proud of. And Brendan, when I think of our growing up, often when people ask about it, I often describe it as colourful and complex. So when I say that, can you, even as brothers, we have different experiences of growing up in the same environment. So what do you think of when I say that?
I always feel privileged, you know, to have had the childhood that we had, and to be exposed to what we were. And a few things, you know, stand out for me, which I think really position me well for the career I had or have had. The first one is that, you know, I understood at a really young age that the players, these elite players, are just people. You know, it was just commonplace for us to have the greats of the game walking through our house. And so I was never really in awe of athletes in that sense. I understood them at a young age that they were people. We had enormous respect and love for what they achieved, but we knew they were more than that. And I also think that it wasn't just our childhood, but it was the period of our childhood. You know, the country was going through enormous change, and particularly in the 80s, as you know, Mum was a great Labor person from her dad, and I took a deep interest in Labor politics. And in the 80s, we had a very reformist Labor government and dinner table. And this is probably, you're a bit older, but dinner at that time was often talking about, you know, where the government was at, how the government was going. Learning about things that I'd never really contemplated, such as the economy, floating the dollar. But this vision that Labor had, this idea that Hawke and Keating could deliver on what Whitlam started, was a really exciting part of the conversation. And at the same time, Dad was trying to play a pivotal role in creating a national football competition. That we had a country that wasn't realising its potential. We had a game that we loved that was struggling economically. And through insightful, visionary reforms and being exposed to people like Alan Ayler, for example, who could execute that, really created a sense of, wow, you know, there's a lot we can do. And in fact, in many ways, we've got a responsibility to convert that childhood and that opportunity into a greater good and a greater purpose.
It's interesting because you touched straight on then almost dual leadership, you know, Hawke Keating, you know, obviously Dad with Alan Ayler, Jack Hamilton, those people at that time. And it was a shared leadership vision, if you like. And I can remember, and I only came across a document, I'm pretty sure you've got a copy of it now, of Dad's trip to the UK and the US in, I think, 1972, where he talked about things like drafting and salary caps and these sorts of things. And then, 25 years later, not even that, no, 15 years later, basically that vision is formed at that time. And I think often in terms of your career and what you did was the capacity to see something really early and then engender or create a compelling enough story for other people to work with you on it. And I do remember those conversations around, you know, it was almost like you had two choices. You voted Labor and you barracked for Richmond. They were almost the only, and it was almost like having a team you supported and they were the two things and in your own way, you've sort of combined the both of them in what you've been able to do. Mm. At what point did you think personally that you could make a difference?
I don't know if there's a single point, but, you know, that trip that Dad took to England ended up being very pivotal to me because he came back with a heap of books on English football and European football. And, of course, before television, I developed my relationship with the game through reading these books. And I was in awe of just the scale of it. And Dad was not a judgmental person in any way. He loved all of the sports. He introduced us, for example, to Peter Moore and Canterbury and rugby league.
The Green Bay Packers.
So he had an abundance mentality. He never thought that love of sport or these things was scarce. And even that was the way he treated people. He never came across to me being competitive in any of his relationships at all. He had this abundance mentality, which is very hard to for many people to live up to because they naturally lack perhaps a bit of confidence. They become competitive. And I really like that. And so he gave me, you know, a free passage to develop a relationship with soccer. And I loved the game in and of itself. I loved the scale of it, the international aspect of it. But I felt that, yeah, obviously you'd followed Dad's footsteps and I wanted to do something which was original. And I had a great friend who, you know, of course, Kimon Taliadoros, who was a very good player who needed some legal help. And so I loved this notion that, hang on, Australia is a great sporting nation. We can become a great football nation. And it was at a time when we had an extraordinary generation of players who were starting to, in the early 90s, play in the Premier League in England, which had just started. We'd made semi-finals at the Barcelona Olympics and under 20 World Cups at that time. And so the players had given the game a lot of credibility.
Who are some of those players?
Well, there's many, but, you know, I would say that Mark Bosnich would be probably the most famous name at that point. Craig Moore. Then shortly thereafter, we have Mark Viduka, Stan Lazaridis, Harry Kuehl, Josip Skoko, really the so-called golden generation.
Yeah.
Paul Okon. Mark Schwarzer. These are John Aloisi. They're all coming through at this time, and Kimon was part of this group, and so really there was a view that developed amongst us that, hang on, the players are giving this game enormous credibility, but that credibility is not matched by the off-field administration, where the game was regarded as a joke. And so I felt that through the players we could, yeah, realise that vision of Australia being a great football nation. Again, with abundance mentality, it wasn't going to take away from the AFL. It wasn't going to take away from rugby league. It was just going to complement what it is that we stand for as a sporting nation.
But how old are you at this time?
Well, it's probably a 5-10 year project. You know, this isn't something you wake up with
But when you started, like when you first were talking to Kim On about those early days, because you were two very young guys, really, weren't you?
Yeah, and we looked young, especially me. You know, not now, but at that time, I was probably 23.
Yeah, yeah. And you'd finished your law degree at that point?
I was what's called an articled clerk. So I'd finished my law degree and I was doing the sort of 12 months. So this is 1992, the 12-month articled clerkship at a law firm called Holding Redlich. And then I would become an admitted lawyer in 93.
And you're representing Kim On, basically, or advising Kim On in regard to his own personal situation. And then that leads to the conversations that you're now talking to with these guys who become the icons of the sport, basically.
Yeah, so Kim On was subject to a transfer system which was very archaic and basically made players the property of their clubs. And it was it was symptomatic of just how, you know, corrupt it was. And at that point, you know, very quickly in 92, 93, there was a Four Corners program which exposed a lot of the corruption. That led to a Senate inquiry, which I spoke on behalf of the players at. And then we decided to challenge the system in the Industrial Relations Commission, which we could do at that point. So in a very quick period of time, through the, you know, mismanagement of the game and the governance and the abuse of the players, we were able to position, and of course we had to set up the Players Association at the same time to create a vehicle, firstly to get, you know, the rights of the players respected. But we developed very quickly, you know, this mantra that the well-being of the game is a precondition to the well-being of the players. Now that wasn't a subservient view that we have to respect the game. It was actually quite the opposite. It was we have to shape the game so that the game can create the rewards and the career paths and the benefits that the players deserve. And so we were very active on the management side of things, even though we were representing the players, which was, of course, a source of tension for those in charge of the game. But we had no other option, because there really wasn't, you know, the National Soccer League was there, but it was by no means tapping the market that we felt that was there for the game.
So it's an extraordinary vision, though, isn't it, that you say, for me to do best by you, we need to change the environment of which you're operating in because we can. That, to me, from, you know, someone who's been on the other side of it, I'd look at people like you and go, hang on, that's not your job. You know, leave that stuff to us, young fella. You know, that's for us to work out. You know, you just look after your boys, you know. So at what point does that penny drop for you that it can only be that? And then how do you build a collective energy to then push that through? Because that is your, I think you said a 5 to 8 year vision for the game, as well as obviously for the, which is actually beyond the life probably of most of those players as well. They're not, the one thing about football is they're rarely thinking, you know, 5 to 10 years out.
Yeah, but I never really felt that about the players. You know, I felt that they, players, I think, are underestimated in terms of the love they have for the game. You know, they've devoted themselves to playing the game since childhood. You know, they love the game as much as anybody. It's very hard to emulate their love of the game. And we're dealing with people that have represented their country. And so the sense of pride in their country is something that they've directly experienced and been able to communicate on a global stage. And so I always felt that they looked beyond their own self-interest. And in fact, this is a really important point about any successful leader in player unionism, is to understand that we go through the generations very quickly. As you're saying, the career path for good ones maybe is 5 years. And so if you're going to be in a role for 10, 15 years, which you really need to be to have a difference, because you've got to do several rounds of bargaining and so on, you're going to go through several generations of players. And so each of those players need to understand what they've inherited And they need to be really dedicated to making sure that the legacy is better than the one that they've inherited. And so, you know, our union is 4 or 5 years old. We're already talking about our history. We're already talking about our value system and our tradition. And we're celebrating our courageous players. You know, Kimon was a courageous player. That action led to, against the transfer system, probably cost him in many ways his career. And other players were willing to do that because they didn't want the players that followed to go through what they went through. But they also felt that what they had was inadequate and where the game was at wasn't good enough. And so they wanted to leave it in a better place. Not there's an altruistic element to it, but there's also a selfish, an enlightened self-interest element to it that, yeah, that they care and they want to have an impact. And the union gives them, that's the best vehicle through which they can have that impact.
And is that how they become willing? Through, because that generation becomes willing when a generation before doesn't, and perhaps a generation after mightn't have either. But there's something about the coming together of that group at that time which brought about a form of courage that, you know, someone like Kimon showed during that time, which now is, you know, seen as just part of the game, as change makers.
Well, the history suggests a bit otherwise. You know, the 74 Socceroos were courageous on pay and issues. They took action. But I met a still a dear friend of mine, an academic named Braham Dabscheck, who came and saw me. He'd been, you know, I used to say he's Australia's leading academic on industrial relations in sport, and he'd always correct me and say, Brendan, I'm the only academic on industrial relations in Australian sport. And he wrote an article for a journal which said we were the seventh attempt at creating a players association. Right. And then about a year later, he wrote an update saying, no, in fact, we're the ninth. So I think the difference was we knew how to get organised. You know, I'd studied labour law. I'd studied the players associations in the United States, particularly the Major League Baseball Players Association. So, you know, when I read Marvin Miller's book, who was the executive director of that from the 60s to the early 80s, it was really the most exciting book I'd ever read from a business sense. And I remember thinking, I know where he's going. And I was almost, you know, I don't want to compare myself to Marvin, but I could see his thinking. And so, you know, I was reading the pages ahead of before I'd read them. And so I understood the strategy of that. And so to, you know, build the association, make sure the players had ownership and control of the association so that they could be courageous without having to sacrifice themselves. That's the whole point of the union. And then in terms of the business case, you know, the first real test of that was in 95 when we brought down the transfer system. You know, we won it legally, but what I was most proud of was when the commission said that we actually agree with the objectives behind the transfer system, you know, competitive balance, economic viability, you know, stable teams. These are all objectives we can't argue with. But the system on the evidence doesn't achieve those things. In fact, it's counterproductive to them. So that was what I was happiest about, because that demonstrated we understood the business better than they did.
Did they think that you did understand the business better? Or were they fighting your right to even have a say in regard to how the business best operates?
No, they didn't want us there. And the only reason we got there was because we had a leverage strategy which involved litigation. Mm. And at that stage with a young union, you know, you're not in a position to be able to, like the Matildas did later on, you know, take strike action. The union's too young, and so the legal action was the best way of going about it, because it gave us leverage at an institutional level when the players didn't have, you know, the litigation was very important also to give us leverage, but also to demonstrate to a young player group which had yet to see that the union had, was proven, that we would actually be impactful. And but when we ran that action, we went out and we surveyed all the players, we met with all of the players, And, you know, even some of the players felt that the transfer system should stay. The thing had been around for 100 years. You know, why would you, you know, challenge it? You know, they couldn't imagine football without it.
And it was still in, I'm sure, in other countries and all that, it's been an embedded part of the game, like, forever, hasn't it, in that sense?
Yeah, well, what we didn't know was that at the same time, the massive European challenge was underway. You know, we didn't have the internet back then. And our case was handed down in June 95. And in December 95, what's called the Bosman ruling was handed down, which gave the players freedom of contract in Europe. That was run by the International Players Union called FIFA Pro. We didn't know that at the time. And so, yeah, the transfer system, you know, the listeners may think, hang on, it still occurs. Players are still being bought and sold. It's a very, very different system to the one we were challenging back then, which was also had a retention element, which basically meant that you couldn't move even when out of contract without the permission of the club. And so the player's ability to negotiate a fair salary and a fair wage was, you know, severely restricted.
So you've gone from university to doing this in what, the space of 6 or 7 years, earlier.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what part of you enables that to happen, do you think?
Look, I was pretty lucky. You know, I had two loves. I'd loved, you know, professionally, you know, the labour movement and sports.
Yeah.
And it just so happened in the 90s, subscription television started all around the world. And so all of these athletes were going from being semi-professional to full-time. You know, when we first started the conversation about the Players Association, most of the players said they didn't need it. There wasn't really an example of successful player associations here in this country. There was a lot of apathy. If we look back now on that, it sounds, you know, pretty ridiculous that players would have those views. But it was a semi-professional era. And so we were transitioning into full-time professionalism. And so the penny dropped for the players at that time. And I remember thinking I was really way too young to do it. But what helped me a lot was the managing partner at the law firm, Peter Redlich, said, "Brendan, you're the same age as the players. So you're actually got the perfect opportunity to build their trust." And so, yeah, that ended up being a help and not a hindrance. By being actually in their peer group. And to be honest, now, years later, some of these players like Craig Foster, Kim On, I've mentioned, Alex Tobin, Andrew Harper, they're among my dearest friends, Francis Owaratifi to this day.
And positioning yourself, and one of the things I'm really interested in exploring with you is being a leader and the idea of leadership, but somehow being an outsider as leader as well. And, you know, I've spoken to you about this before, but I even found sometimes as a CEO inside an organization, you felt a little bit like an outsider at different times, but you are the outsider. You're the stone in the shoe of a lot of people at this point. How did you cope with that personally during that time?
I was just aware of it, you know. So when I first started building the Players Association, I'd never meet with a player without having other players there. I'd always build relationships and then expand it that way. You know, I wasn't a player, remember. You know, I came at, and so I'd never pretended I wasn't who I wasn't. You know, I'm a young lawyer. I believe in you guys. I think we can take the game somewhere. And, you know, the players responded to that. You know, they're going to trust you if they think you're a good person and you're competent. Character and competence are the keys. And so if you can demonstrate that. As we move forward and, you know, collective bargaining has started and so on, you know, I think there was a sense really, you know, you buy into the game. You know, this outsider notion becomes much, much bigger. Football people are outsiders. Soccer people are outsiders in this country. You know, they're from migrant communities. The game was seen as a joke. You know, when I was first involved, people would look at me and say, "You're mad. You know, you've grown up in this AFL family. Why are you wasting your time in football?" You know, there was an outsider even with that element with my own people. that they were saying, hang on, you're not doing what you should be doing. And that migrant story sort of inspired me a bit, you know. If you look at it, if you're a, say, Mark Schwarzer, or Mark Viduka is a better example. Well, they're both great examples. Mark plays for Melbourne Knights, Melbourne Croatia. It's all he wanted to do. But he's an outsider in this country. He then goes, plays in Europe, where he's now an Aussie soccer player in Europe. And he's an outsider because Australians don't play football. Fortunately, he's of a different talent level that he can overcome those difficulties. But it was very difficult for him, especially when he went to Celtic. They then bring that back to this country where they're outsiders again. And so for me, I understand the leadership can be lonely, but I think that's a different concept than being an outsider.
That is.
Yeah.
No, it is. It's a, although sometimes even in complex organisations where the assumption inside organisations, particularly football clubs, because they're seen as very much an entity in itself. But I found probably the greatest challenge even as a leader was to work out that sometimes the enemy was wearing the same colours. You know, they were wearing, you know, red and blue or black and yellow, whatever it might have been. That we actually had forces inside which were actually making what we were trying to do so much more challenging because of the, you know, the ambition, ego, and often difference of opinion, really, as much as anything. How did you go about winning, you know, that, you know, the character competency thing you talked about, that's built over time, but you're asking people to back you in, aren't you? And then asking them to buy in on whatever vision you're actually creating for it. What are some of the your ways and techniques of actually creating that?
It's a difficult question. I would say you just keep going. You know, someone said to me the other day, I'm just waiting for the green light to do something. And he was referring to people above him. I said, no, wait till they put up a red light, you know, and then you stop. And I think that's really important. You just have to keep the momentum going. And I must say, when I looked back, you know, we set up the union in 93, the PFA. We've closed down the NSL and starting to set up the new league in 2003. So it's only been 10 years. So I look back now with three decades and go, gee, that's not that long. But at the time, it felt like forever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So we knew where we were going. We saw, you know, I mentioned the generations of players who were suffering. So we were very impatient. And so I think we had a very clear vision. And we had a very clear mantra, a very clear philosophy about how we were going to go about it, which the players took ownership of.
Where does that start, though? Like it clears almost an outcome, isn't it? Like clarity around something as ambiguous, as difficult, as challenging as what you achieved or seeking to achieve. The story starts somewhere. Was it always evolving for you, or was it something that you saw as a light at the top of the hill at some point that if we bring this group of people together, this special group of people, we can achieve something that, yes, what we are standing as Braham said, on the shoulders of others, there's no doubt, but we can create something that people can well and truly stand on our shoulders for the next however many generations. Is it just always evolving for you, that vision for it, or new opportunities as you see them? Because you're a great storyteller. Was the storytelling element of it for you as part of it?
Well, you know, we were dealing with a brutal economy, right? So it's not like we had much of a choice, you know, but we felt we could solve the problems. I think that's what differentiated us from the other stakeholders. We felt we could solve the problems. So when, after a couple of rounds of collective bargaining in the National Soccer League, it became apparent that that wasn't going to solve our problems. We had a very strong personality as the chairman of the game, a guy named David Hill, who tried to reform the National Soccer League. And it became clear, you know, that was really a process of cannibalization. So when you're in enormous uncertainty, which we were in, you have to, and very political, there was really only two things that we did which made us different. The first one was, and Kimon said this to me at the very start, if we're going to challenge the governance of the game, we have to have impeccably clean hands. So the ethical conduct of and the transparent conduct of what we did was just essential, because they're going to want to come after us. And the second was to resolve these problems with knowledge. And so we became a very, people would say data-driven now, but at that point we were research-based. So when we committed to the new national competition, which is now the A-League, and it's going through difficult periods, I think, because they've departed from the learnings of that research, we actually didn't have a vested interest in whether we would create that competition or not. We wanted the question answered, would a professional men's competition be viable in this country, and if so, on what circumstances? We weren't a wealthy organisation. We spent about $500,000 in researching that. The market research, the qual, the quant, the governance model, the broadcast rights. And we were satisfied that if we did it in a certain way, it could work. And then we had to convince a 16-team league to vote for it, which would be an 8-10 team league. So, and the players
they had to vote themselves out of business.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And Simon Colosimo and I were talking about that vote the other day, you know, and we had all of the players represented. But there were the economic circumstances were such, you know, we were in a crisis, and a crisis can be a great change point. But what management was unable to do was to come up with the solutions. And fortunately, there were a lot of people that loved the game, fans, the media were very important, and government took an interest. There was one owner in particular, a guy named Nick Tanner from Perth Glory, who had set the standard with his own franchise. He took a great interest, and we were able to convince FIFA that we needed to do something, because FIFA have a rule that you can't have political interference. And so if the government was going to be involved, then there was a risk that the federation would go to FIFA and say the Australian government is interfering. But FIFA knew that something needed to happen. And I remember flying and meeting the Secretary General, a guy named Zen Rufinen, and talking to him about that. And yeah, they just turned a blind eye, really, which they don't always do. So that was the hard work. The hard work was building the knowledge base and then getting the political change. But then it was taken out of our hands, to be honest. Like, the government took over, and that became a source of frustration when the reforms were taken. And the mistake I made in that reform process was probably to weaken the Players Association inadvertently, because our membership was being put out of work. And so when the reforms were completed, and I was part of the task force that Frank Lowy put in place that designed the reforms, but when the reforms were put in place, we pretty much had to start again. And that was a bit of a wake-up call.
Mm. What was the main thing you learned from that, do you think?
You never give up your position of leverage unnecessarily. You know, never assume that a good deed will be reciprocated. You know, business doesn't work that way. You know, you've just got to maintain. And it took us 3 or 4 years to get our position back, really.
Is that right? You often talk of leverage and the importance of leverage. Obviously, from a pure trade union position, it's always about that. What about from a leadership perspective? Do you think of them as different or somehow together? Like, because leverage can be also seen as an unhealthy, almost like a standover aspect of your being. But, you know, you need to do it. One part of you is doing it all the time. There's another part inside an organisation as well.
Yeah, look, I think I was better managing out and up rather than down, to be honest, looking back. You know, we were a very small organization for a long time. There was never really, any possibility of realizing even a collective bargaining agreement or these industry-wide reforms without, you know, a significant leverage strategy. People won't do things just because it's the right thing to do in a sport as clandestine and as political as football. And so we spent a lot of time on that. And I'd studied the best unions around the world. And the ones that had the strongest seat at the table were also the ones that had been the most militant. And that doesn't mean that they were selfish in their actions. I think that the before and after test is that the players and the business of the game both benefited. But without that, they were just not equal at the table.
Where does the appetite come from? You know, you said you studied. And I can remember you studying as you were doing more homework when you were 12 than I was doing when I was 17. You know, you seem to have that aspect of you started early and has held you in really good stead your whole life. Is that just an inbuilt part of you, do you think?
Well, I think it's a strength and a weakness. You know, I'm actually quite introverted, so I enjoy reading and the paperwork. And leadership is an external challenge of communication. And so, you know, it can be challenging if you're that way, if you have those preferences. I think we all have learning preferences. And one of the things I learned when I did my MBA is to understand how people learn, and people all learn differently. Some very few are good readers. You know, most people are listeners or they're observers. And I think when you're building a group of players, you know, one of the things I really quickly understood was that they've all got their own ways and they've all got their own views of conflict. And so, you know, a guy like Kimon, for example, could be a very brave leader, but he would never want to ask the players in his dressing room to join up to the union because he'd say, well, Brendan, that's their choice. I said, yeah, I know, but we need them to join. You'd have to get someone else to do that job. You know, someone would be very good at communicating with 20 or 30 players around an issue. And so we had to develop that. That was one of the really enjoyable aspects, was to find out which players have an appetite and a capacity for this type of leadership, which sport at that stage wasn't accustomed to, and build structures around it so that you would nurture that leadership. You know, we would always have a delegates group of at least 7 in the national teams. We would have at least 3 in all of the clubs, experienced players, young players, you know, more established players, always working on the next generation and finding out those ones who really enjoyed being part of it. And one of the things that gives me a lot of pleasure is when these groups come together, and we're talking players that have had immense careers, and I was speaking with Alex Tobin the other day about it, who captained Australia many, many times, played 87 times for Australia. He looks back at some of the big disputes as some of the most enjoyable and rewarding parts of their career. So you need to make these with leverage. You need to make it fun. And you can make it fun for players because they're competitive, right? They love winning. So if you turn it into a contest, right, and we would say there's two contests here, okay? There's the one you play on the field, okay? That's a matter for your coaches and yourselves and so on. But off the field, there's a contest and there's two participants. There's management and there's us. And this is how we win. Now, when it's done really well, it's a cliche, it'll be a win-win. But you need to get to that stage. But, the competitive element of the players, if they're organised the right way, is very, very powerful.
Did the contest ever become a contest with each other? Like you have the contest as in, I want my team to win. And if you're representing the country, it's different. But within your team environment, your club environment, the people are paying your salary and all those sorts of things. And the contest that you're asking them to have almost in opposition to that at different times, that would have been a challenging little place for, you know, some of the stronger leaders who are often leaders within their teams are having to play both roles. You know, fight like the devil on a match day, and then, you know, potentially put themselves in conflict with the same people inside their organisations.
Yes and no. I think that could be a problem in certain sports. You know, where you have a very strong club structure. But no, I think that, you know, see, the PFA in England had been very successful. And so we were very keen to develop from the outset that players owe each other a duty of care, that there was a sense of loyalty to the profession and to your fellow professional that transcended club loyalty. And so club loyalty was almost something that we didn't allow to become a factor. It was a little bit where you had players who had oppressive management who would put them under a lot of pressure, but that was more the problem rather than really loyalty to the club.
And that would almost help you, wouldn't it, in some ways?
Well, you can, but you have to be able to address the player's fear. You know, I remember a guy who's now a good friend of mine, Remo Nogarotto. He was secretary of the Liberal Party and he owned a club called Northern Spirit, and one day decided to sack our delegates. And so we had to take him to the federal court and settle that matter. There just comes a time where you go, if they can do that. And we weren't lit. We, like I've mentioned a couple of major cases, but we weren't, you know, profligate in our litigation at all. We just didn't have the resources. But if all of a sudden your delegates aren't safe, then everything can collapse. And so on something like that, you really have no choice. Yeah, it was a bit of a law of the jungle type industry, and I think in many ways this is why it failed. And that's why we had to, you know, start again. Like the A-League was a brand new competition. It wasn't a reform. It wasn't like what the AFL did. It was like what happened in America. We had to close it down, set up Major League Soccer, and that's what we had to do here. We really did four things. We closed down the national competition and set up a new one. We closed down the governing body and set up a new one. We went from Oceania to Asia, and we embraced gender equality. They were really the four big reforms, all made possible by collective bargaining. But when I say we, it's a big we. Like we're talking hundreds of people.
Mm. And how do you win support for people from people who you've actually spent a fair bit of time almost arguing against? Or was it so new that it was actually a new group of people that you found yourself in conversation with around those four big reforms? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people who are very embedded in the culture of the sport who had to play a role. Could they see the vision that you were talking to at that point, or were they fighting for the old way?
They fought for the old way to really from say 93 to 2003, and then the penny sort of dropped for them. But I think taking a step back and not just looking at this as a case study, you know, it's important to build the confidence of your group. So union leadership is always about building the confidence of the group that they will prevail. And so they need to have a strategy that they can get their head around and that they think will ultimately be successful. When it comes to the people you're dealing with on the other side of the table, there always has to be respect. Now, you don't need to be liked. And if you want to be liked, to be honest, you're in the wrong job. Right. I never worried about being liked, but respect was very important because respect meant that they thought you could do a job and ultimately they needed to deal with you. So, you know, I'm a good friend now with Remo Nogarotto, for example. We probably, he became one of the leaders of the reform effort, super intelligent guy, completely opposite politics to my own, but there was always that respect. And also, you know, to make sure not just as at an individual level, but the collective group is respected. And they would always, you know, Frank Lowy straight away when he came in tried to deal with the players individually. You know, he came in and tried to take our best Socceroos and do one-on-one deals with them because that's what they're going to do. And so we had to make sure that there was enough of a sense of solidarity that the players understood that collective action will always be better than individual negotiations.
And again, that puts them into the players themselves have to be seriously bought in on a vision other than their own during that period of time when that sort of pressure's actually, on them. But you don't have access to these guys like every day of your life. They're not like in your club. They're not like in your office. They're playing all over the world. They're in different places. How do you build a collective vision for something in such a fragmented way? And I think people would relate to that because sometimes, you know, if you're a leader of a big organisation, you're wondering, gee, I feel very distant from my workforce. I feel very distant from my people. So you're trying to, these guys are under severe pressure and have high expectations of themselves, at the same time having to buy in on something which, you know, they're not seeing you every day. You're not reinforcing the conversation. So how did you go about that process?
Well, they're all different. I think one of the things I did when I first started with the PFA, it was just me and the secretary, and then we bring a lawyer on board and we grow it. I never looked at us as a small organisation. I said we're a 300-400 person organisation. So they're all different. There are some players who are just going to be immediately responsive. Then there's going to be really important players who are hard to contact. But they're all going to have relationships and people they trust. And so you just need to really understand who they listen to, who they relate to, and make sure that, you know, when you can. And as the thing opened up, you know, I would travel a lot, you know, and go and meet with them and have lunch with them and see them in their clubs and do all of that work and just build the relationships. But also sometimes what you can do is if they're in a difficult situation, them just delegating it to the union is the easy way out for them. They don't, sometimes you don't ask someone to make a big commitment. You just say, hey, just let this one pass. You don't have to buy in on this. If they're putting pressure on you, that you don't have to make that your problem. You've got a whole group of players who are working to make that our problem. And so little escape routes for people are important. You know, you can't make everything big. Sometimes, you know, pressure points just can be released with a minimal amount of anxiety.
Mm. No, it's interesting. And my sense also as you're speaking then was that even those who are under that severe pressure could see the quality of work that you're doing for others who found themselves in very difficult situations at different times, which the one thing that the sport can do is create a complex issue for a young person to deal with, you know, at the height of his earning potential as well, or her earning potential. So how important was that aspect of it where they could see the quality of work that you were doing for, you know, individuals in the sport?
Oh, huge, you know, like we built, it was really a law firm really, you know, when we first got up and running, and the grievance work we do is massive. And there are two, there's the grievance arbitration at the domestic level. But I mentioned the Bosman decision earlier. We through FIFPro have been able to reach an agreement with FIFA that we have a global mechanism for enforcing rights. And, you know, one of my favourite cases is for a player named Matthew Spiranovic and his agent Bernie Mandich, who Bernie rang me one day and said, oh dear, I think I've made a mistake on Matthew's contract because the club can release him after the first year of 2 years. And each was $1 million US net a year, I think it was. And I looked at the contract and I said, no, don't worry about it, Bernie. I think Matthew will be fine. He was playing in Qatar. So the club tried to terminate him. We had to get him out, actually, which was a problem because they had kafala system, which meant that he couldn't leave the country without the approval of the employer, which meant we'll give you the approval if you waive all of your entitlements. So we got Gary Moretti, who's now the head of national teams at Football Australia, worked at FIFA for a while and was then the team, like, manager, not coach, but, you know, general manager. We got him to write a letter to the Qatar FA to say Matthew's been selected for a camp. So Matthew escaped the country and we filed a case at Zurich. So the clause is unbalanced under this international agreement we have. This is an unbalanced clause. Matthew can't terminate on the same terms. If he terminates, he has to pay the contract out. Can you believe that? A player pay $1 million to his club to leave the contract, but the club can do it without any liability. The FIFA, it goes to what's called the dispute resolution chamber. They held for us. So Matthew's entitled to his $1 million for the second year of the contract. They appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport in Lausanne. They uphold our decision. And so then how do we get the money out of the club? Well, FIFA writes to the club and says, look, if you don't pay, you'll suffer sanctions, which means you won't be able to contract new players and we'll deduct points from you. It's an incredible system that's been built. So you have an Australian worker sacked in Qatar in accordance with the terms of his contract, and we can enforce his rights. And so building that kind of system has really been enormously rewarding. And, you know, thousands of players have benefited through this type of thing. And I love Matthew's case because it sort of brings so many of the different elements to it. And just the common sense about resolving the kafala system. Now, to put that in context, the kafala system was one of the major human rights abuses that was brought to light when Qatar were awarded the World Cup and the international labour movement moved to have the kafala system abolished as part of the expose into migrant worker abuses in Qatar around 2022.
And that was probably the sort of the next stage of the conversation I'd like to have with you, is that it ends up being a human rights role, doesn't it? Your job, like you start as the 23-year-old Article Clark setting up a players' association in Australia in a sport which, as you said, was in pretty poor shape, and then, you know, 20 odd years later, a little bit longer, you find yourself CEO. And I've never quite understood the title. It was of Uni Global, of the sport director. So explain the title again, that of the role that you played in Switzerland. I've always just said you were CEO of the Global Sports Union is how I always described it. Yeah.
Yeah. So what we did was we set up, I was working with FIFPro. I was vice president of FIFPro, the World Players Union. And we set up a global Players Association, which we branded the World Players Association once I was in the role. So I was executive director of that. It's a peak body of about 120 player associations across around 20 professional team sports, and 85,000 players come under the umbrella. And that includes the really strong unions in the United States, you know, such as Major League Baseball, NBA and others. But, you know, football was the lion's share, and that's how I got the opportunity through my work for football. Of those 85,000 players, 65,000 are footballers. Right. So that gives you the sense of just the scale of the game.
And the role? What if you had to say, what were the key, if you've done a good job and we're sitting back and say, yeah, I did a pretty good job, what have you achieved? What were some of the important metrics in regard to a role such as that?
Well, it was really establishment. We had got it to a gentleman named Walter Palmer, a former NBA player, fantastic guy. He was working with Uni Global Union. So that's like the World Services Union. And so the World Players Association was part of this massive trade union, which we call a global union federation. So this is, I won't take you into the world of international labour politics, but so we were part of this broader union, and we'd actually got the player associations to agree that it's a good thing. And as I was saying, like this pod, you know, in the arena, that was one of the speeches that I used in trying to motivate the group with Walter as to why we should be a part of it. What we all have in common is we represent, you know, the people in the arena in all the various different sports. And really, we were just set up, you know, you have to reduce this complex stuff down to small bits, right? And I just say we do two things. We advance the common concern and we advance best practice in union representation. And that's been really important because this job has been getting harder and harder every day. And it was really brought to light during COVID when we could share resources, excuse me, when we could share resources from the big unions that had the best medical care and the best experts on the pandemic to enable sport to return to play in a safe way all around the world. That was a really good example as to why this organisation was created, that the AFLPA would learn from the NFLPA on return to play protocols, for example, just at a time when we're still trying to understand what this was all about.
So that is pure leadership in that sense. And then there's often then the examples of it playing out in a relatively public way, the value of what you're bringing. And the idea which comes to mind, or the thing that comes to mind, is you might have to give a little bit of the backstory with the passage of time, is the work you did with Hakeem. So you might just talk us through that experience.
Yeah, look, I think there's a couple of interesting things with Hakeem. So Hakeem's a Bahraini refugee who participates in the pro-democracy peace protests in Bahrain around 2011, and he's ultimately granted asylum in Australia. So backstory is, why did we get involved in human rights? Well, there was an incredible documentary on ESPN after the Arab Spring by a guy named Jeremy Schapp, and it was called The Athletes of Bahrain. And we were having a meeting of the Asian division of FIFPro in Goa in 2012. And we're good labor unions at this stage. And I showed the documentary to the group. It's probably about 10 unions there, Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, Indonesia, even Palestine. And it's about how, in response to the Arab Spring, the Bahraini royal family and the authorities targeted the athlete activists, pretty much for the same reason Nike sponsors Michael Jordan. They're a good way to make a point publicly. And the Hubal brothers, two of the leading players in the Bahraini national team, Muhammad and Alaa Hubal, were interviewed. They'd been detained and tortured. And so at the end of showing this documentary, I asked the group, what would happen if one of our members was in this situation? What would we do? And we all recognised that we absolutely had no idea what we could do. There was nothing we could do. It was completely beyond our competency. When I started the role at the World Players Association, I'd studied leverage in all of the unions around the world and what made them strong. And it really came down to recognising the players as workers. Therefore, they can form a union and act collectively, and we can challenge the restraints, the anti-competitive, the antitrust type of structures. And that restraint of trade litigation has been important in all the sports, football, basketball, NFL, Australian rules, all of them about giving players a voice. But it dawned to me at the global level, these three aspects of leverage weren't available to me. No. And so I thought I should have realized this before I took on the role. But at the time, FIFA was under, and rightly so, under enormous pressure over awarding the World Cup to Qatar. And so there was a tipping point emerging around the intersection between sport and human rights. Now, this is something I'd been interested in. Like, even in the late 90s, it had emerged that the soccer balls that some of our members had been used had been manufactured by child labour in Pakistan. And so we had to start addressing supply chains, and Nike and Adidas and these brands had big problems with their supply chains. And so it's not just about stopping child labour. It's about getting the kids in school, getting the parents employed. It's a big deal about how you actually solve these problems. And so the international community had developed a concept called the United Nations Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. And so FIFA accepted that the problems in Qatar were not just the problems of the Qatari government, but they had awarded the tournament. They knew there was going to be a massive construction effort. They knew there was going to be a massive influx of migrant labour. They needed to do their human rights due diligence. They needed to be able to know and show that the rights of these people would be respected. And they were egregiously not being respected. And so that occurred to me that we need to be in this for the right reasons. We're going to be playing in these stadiums, right? So we need to be aware of these issues. Our members are going to be asked about them. But also, if FIFA now is going to embed the human rights of everyone associated with the games, local communities, and there was awful stories when we did work around Olympics. We had meetings with people in Rio about, I still remember meeting a mother whose son was shot dead in the security crackdown. I met a woman who had stood arm to arm with other mothers as they bulldozed the favelas to make space for the construction of the Olympic Games. You know, these stories, I helped a woman named Bilkis Abdul-Kadir, an American basketball player, play basketball in a hijab. We had to change FIBA's rules to do that. So these are really, you know, she had to choose between her two things in life, sport and her faith. So these were incredibly powerful things. But strategically, it occurred to me that if we could embed the human rights of everyone affected by sport, we've got to embed the human rights of the players. And therefore, we can change global sports law to be for all the athletes a little bit like what it was when I was mentioning Matthew Spiranovic, you know, a sports legal system that respects rights. And so we did all of this work, and this meant that not only did we have to create an awareness of human rights amongst the player associations, we wrote and adopted what's called the Universal Declaration of Player Rights, which was an articulation of international human rights law to sport. We had to work in partnership with all the human rights groups. So we built what's called the Sport and Rights Alliance, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Transparency International, the International Trade Union Confederation, et cetera, all came together to lobby to respect human rights in sport in a legal sense. And what that meant was when I got an email from Minky Warden, the director of Human Rights Watch, saying, we've got a guy in a Thai jail named Hakim Al-Arabi. He's a footballer. They want to send him back to Bahrain, where he's almost certain to suffer at least torture, probably worse. We knew that Bahrain had previously refouled someone, and that person didn't survive the flight, right? Then we had to act. But we're now in 2019. When I showed the documentary was 2012. And so had Hakim been through what he went through in 2012, we wouldn't have been able to protect him. But we'd done this work now. And so this movement went into action. FIFA had a human rights policy. It couldn't deny that it had responsibilities. It had to maximise its leverage on the three governments, Thailand, Bahrain and Australia, to get Hakim back to Australia. He was in Bangkok because he was having a honeymoon. He'd been granted asylum in Australia. He was entitled to safe passage, but Interpol had wrongly activated an alert from Bahrain, who wanted him back because they had false charges against him of criminal activity in and around the Arab Spring. In fact, he was accused of doing something, setting fire to a police station, when in fact he was filmed playing a match at the same time. It was a great example of, you know, we were able to prevail. You know, I have mixed feelings about it. The reason we were able to prevail was that we were able to galvanize a movement, and that Hakim was a highly visible victim. And what I haven't mentioned is the reason he was so visible was that he had spoken out against Sheikh Salman's candidacy for the FIFA presidency. So he was the Bahraini who challenged for the presidency when Infantino won the election. And so he was targeted because of that. Why had he spoken out? He felt that any member of a family that had overseen the torturing of their own athletes isn't fit to be the president of FIFA. And so, yeah, I sort of look back on that meeting in Goa and then the outcome for Hakim to say, well, what the reason we actually built that capacity was that everyone in the room had the courage to say, I don't know. I don't know what to do. We wouldn't be able to help these people. Had we tried to brush it off, and the reason we did that was, I think, one, we cared. And two, we were honest. And those two things were really enough.
And that's powerful. That's powerful. And it's because I've been in rooms where that I don't know room. My first response often and nothing to that level in terms of, you know, the lives and well-being of people, or perhaps in an indirect way, where my first thought is, well, it's someone else's problem. You've basically, your choice was to make it almost your problem. We need to fix that. Is that because that's embedded in sort of the values and expectations of the work you do? Because I'm sure it's not there for everyone. And like we're dealing with it in sort of other ways. The health and safety issues in and around athletes is always going to be a conversation, but it's a conversation that we're having now in a way that we wouldn't have had, you know, when you first started out in regard to it. But in this case, we're talking about, you know, the political torture of people. Like, this is just extreme. This is, you know, the world can't sort this stuff out. And this group of people are prepared to have this conversation inside a room and say, okay, what would we do? And okay, saying, well, not that we don't know, but we're still prepared to take responsibility.
Yeah, I think if you're in this movement, you know, you can't, and you look at your players as people, you can't just pick and choose which part of the person, you know, you want to help. You know, obviously we're not involved in all aspects of their lives, but their fundamental rights, you know, if, you know, we often say, if we don't act, who will? That's a very important question to ask. If we didn't do that, no one would have. And I think the sad reality from the Hakim case is this. You know, we still have a lot of work to do to build up what I would call a human rights system. Hakim was saved by the movement, by the incredible campaign led by Craig Foster and many others. But he was a visible victim. And most victims of human rights abuse are invisible. And so, therefore, they're dependent on the system, and the system isn't yet built. The system is still failing athletes. And so the union's job is to build that system. And one of my favourite stories is about Don Fear, who ran as executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association after Marvin Miller. And there was a massive strike in 94 which cancelled the World Series. This lovely story that Don Fear tells. In fact, Don wouldn't tell me it because he's too humble. People wouldn't understand that with being such a leader. But Jeff Fennell, one of his lawyers, told me the story. There's a famous player in baseball called Willie Mays. Okay, Willie played in the old era. There's a famous play in the World Series called The Catch. You can look it up on YouTube, Willie Mays, The Catch. And so Don's got the executive board of the Major League Baseball players, and they're meeting after the strike, and they've settled their CBA, and they're getting ready to go back to work. And so you've got the greats of baseball there. And Don gets up and says, a lot of great players in this room, but no one here is better than Willie Mays. And all the players go, yeah, that's fair. But geez, you've got better conditions than Willie Mays, right? And that's because you work under a different system. You work under a system that's collectively bargained, in which you have an equal say. That's what collectively bargaining is. It's just giving the players an equal say. We strive for an equal say, not an upper say, not equal. And it's such a powerful message because what it says is, you know, I remember doing some work with FIFPro and Ronaldo said, look, I don't really need the union. Hang on. If you were playing in 1960, you'd be on £20 a week. The maximum wage applied to everyone. The reason you're paid like you are now is because of what the player union movement did from 1960 to 1995 in many ways, which gave you the opportunity to start to get your value. You're getting your value because of the union. So the fact he doesn't know that is a failure of storytelling and a failure of leadership. But what Don's message is saying is that the very, very best players need the union, as do the guys on the minimum wage. And as we now have, you know, and I think the most exciting aspect of our movement over the last half a dozen years has been, you know, the emergence of women's sport and our fight for gender equality, because in many ways those pioneering players remind me of the Craig Fosters and the Alex Tobins and the Kimons and that of 30 years ago. And they're always talking about their legacy. They're always talking about what they're trying to create. They're not selfish. And I just think it's not right to assume that athletes are narrow-minded and selfish.
Well, there's actually a big part of them which almost requires and expects that of them. They come in, you know, one of the things I often talk about is that, say, in the AFL system where we draft them at 18, is that we actually do draft people who are selfish young men. Probably there's nothing more selfish than the high-performing 18-year-old male, really. But to survive in any system, and particularly in a game such as Australian football, if you can't learn selflessness, well, you've got no chance, you know, regardless of talent. And there's just a thousand examples of people who, through their pure selflessness, have created careers for themselves and obviously been part of wonderful teams because of the example that they then set. And as I'm listening to you speak, I'm thinking of it in that same context, to be honest, because it's just a different but the same version of a form of selflessness. That it's very easy for people to put their success down to their own effort, you know, in any environment, and even in individual sports, I would think as well. Whereas we're all the product of some, you know, of an environment of which has made us what we are, and our ability to adapt to whatever that environment is. And so, what you've been able to create in, you know, right from the very outset, and you know, from the very early stage to now, a very macro environment is a version of that. You've created the conditions which enable a group of people to achieve something that perhaps they never ever thought they could. Even the decision to show a documentary to a group of people in 2012 is, you know, and so the visual of that, then I think of the visual of Hakeem in, what's the term, when they got their all...
Shackles.
Shackles, yeah, when he was shackles and, you know, shackled on his honeymoon, you know, this good-looking athlete, you know, being shackled into court or jail, whatever the thing was with Craig talking about it, that, you know, the visual, people's capacity to visualise that type of thing. And so the vision for that comes from somewhere, and I think that's your greatest legacy. And there's obviously the interesting thing that you talk about is that a lot of your wisdom clearly comes through the conversations you've had with some very wise people over the journey. But as a reader, you're also giving yourself access to the wisdom of people you'll never get to meet. You know, you're a searcher from that point of view. And so the growth personally for you has created outcomes for, you know, some people who in many cases you wouldn't even know them that well, I wouldn't imagine. All of a sudden they just appear, you know, an email arrives, such as Hakeem. Had you heard of Hakeem before that email had arrived?
I think I'd just been aware of him as a player who had spoken out against Sheikh Salman. I had a vague recollection of that, but only that.
And then now to achieve what you did, and he's got to get on with the rest of his life too. That's obviously going to be, it's interesting then what happens beyond it for all athletes, really, beyond the game is something which everyone always will be challenged by. We do ask athletes to have two lives, really, in many ways. So the idea of growth and probably, you know, the one thing which in the work I do now is that idea of learner-teacher is very strong but rarely talked about, you know, in leadership, I think. You know, the role of leader as teacher, because clearly whether they were actually teaching you or not, you've learned lessons from them, you know, the people who you've got to work with and those who have had the courage to put their work out there, such as a Marvin Miller in the books that he wrote. The whole idea of growth and learning, when I talk to that, what do you think about?
Yeah, well, what I would say to our group all the time, and increasingly so because the rate of development is so fast, is as what Craig Johnston said. I don't know if you know, the Liverpool player in the car park at Middlesbrough, you know, not being able to play, said, well, I can do now, and he designed his own training drills, is to go to bed a better footballer than when I woke up. And he trained himself in the car park at Middlesbrough. And then sure enough, they're short for a training, for a practice match on the eve of Christmas because all the other apprentices have gone home, and he gets his opportunity, and within 18 months he's the most expensive player in England. I got to go to bed a better footballer than what I woke up. Now, he had the intellect at the age of 15 to be able to design his drills to actually do that. It's one thing to have the capacity, to have the goal. It's another to be actually able to carry it off. And so I would say that a lot to our group that, you know, with things are developing so quickly now that if we're not learning and growing, we're actually going backwards. We're going home worse than what we arrived at work. And the players don't pay us to do that, right? But also organising is teaching. Ultimately, when it's all said and done.
When you say organising, as in organising a group of players inside your movement.
Yeah, organising is really our core business and we haven't really spoken about it. But ultimately, what we're about is how organised the players are as a collective in pursuit of our goals. And
is being organised the most underrated thing?
Well, organising is sort of a term of art in union circles.
But even in life.
Yeah, maybe.
Because often I write these five things down each day, you know, do good work, be present with family and friends, find a creative space. Talking to the sort of the more things that you would think about in life. But my last one I always write is stay organized. Mm. Stay organized. Because I know whatever other goal, whatever objective, if I become disorganized, either disorganized in my thinking, disorganized in my activity, none of the goals will be achieved. And it's just such a simple way of thinking. Sometimes, whereas your whole mindset starts almost from that perspective, doesn't it? If a form of organisation is required, the organisation driven by goals, underpinned by values, these types of things. But it's a word that you go straight to, which I almost have to convince people to be it in lots of ways.
Well, there's been organised at an individual level and then there's been organised collectively.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean?
But a team playing, did the team play organised? You know, you can watch a sporting team get disorganised by the opposition's effort to unravel its organisation in terms of system and those sorts of things.
Yeah, and like in a major negotiation, if you don't plan, like there's, if you don't factor on what the other side's going to do, then you're not prepared and you're not organised. And I love that film 13 Days when JFK is being told by the Joint Chiefs of Staff that they should do a ground invasion at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he says to the Joint Chiefs, well, what will they do if we do that? And the Joint Chief says, they won't do anything, Mr. President. And he says, well, don't know about that. I think they're definitely going to do something. And it's incredible how often in this scenario that people don't factor that in. Hmm. Yeah, they're going to try and get to your delegates. They're going to try and get to the players. They're going to try and divide you. Of course they are. So if you're not prepared for that, they're going to countersue. You have to factor all of that into your planning. They might lock you out. Like that's one of the biggest things in America now, you know. And how long could you last if they did that? You know, if you want to start a battle, you've got to assume that they're going to elevate it. And then you've got to know precisely how long you can last. And if you don't do that, then, you know, you're going to lose. And so these are all parts of the calculations that go into it. But organising in the sense that I'm mentioning it is essentially educating the players that what we want to achieve is something they have ownership of and that they fully understand. And, you know, I mentioned briefly the Matilda strike in 2015. You know, when you watch the footage of all of that, there's no union staff there. They're all in the background. There's no PFA staff. It's Lydia Williams and it's all the players speaking for themselves. And they're the ones in the negotiations. They're the ones presenting the proposals. Sure, we do all the paperwork, but ultimately the players are the union. And when you get to that stage, and Marvin was the first one really to pioneer that. He would refuse to meet management without players being represented. He took it to that level. It became a rule of his conduct.
No, it's powerful, and you sit and watch how I don't think, probably obviously the Cathy Freeman moment, but I don't think I've ever seen anything brought together or bring it together a country like what the Matildas did. You know, in that it was the conversation everyone was having. It's very rare for that to happen at any level. So what's your own, you know, when you're sitting there quietly watching it, what goes through your mind when you see something like that?
Look, I think, you know, those players had a vision which well extended beyond mine when they first approached me in 2007 asking to be organised by the PFA, and that was just the national team. And the sacrifice that they went through, you know, football was really a side hustle. But there's an extraordinary leader who was part of that group, a woman named Kate Gill, who's now co-chief executive of the PFA. And, you know, I actually, when I went to the PFA Awards last year and they were talking about the values of the organisation that we have, intelligence is one of those values, courage, respect, world-class, trust. You know, they've taken that to a new sense of meaning. So the love of the game and the sport, the interest was great, but also the country was proud that these players stood for something, that they were fighting for gender equality, that there was actually a cause, that they resembled something that transcended the sport. So again, we look back and we go, oh, that dispute, was it harmful? That dispute was an enormous enabler. And it changed the conversation in a way which I think added to the story and the accomplishments of that team, which is incredibly diverse and fighting for an equal seat at the table for women, which is, I think, really inspiring.
Yeah, it has. Oh, inspiring is the right word, and it's interesting that even the idea around inspiration, it seems to me, comes from a place of humility, right? You know, there's almost a sense when you watch them that each of the individual stories that these guys have it's kicking a football in a park with no one. It's finding their own passion for the game, and you know, and often getting very little encouragement. I think of that particularly, you know, with the women's AFL. You know, I got to know Debbie Lee very well, and she's one of the great people in Australian football. Who she tells stories of playing games, and people would come to the games only to mock them. Only to mock them. In fact, she tells a story about a ute which turned up, which had a spa in the back where guys, you know, sat in a spa, drank beers and mocked them. Like it was like an enormous effort into there to do that. And to understand then, and I got to work with her, is she's the most dedicated football person I'd ever met in my life because there'd been no aspect of anyone else associated with Melbourne Football Club at the time. No one associated with the Melbourne Football Club at that time had shown more dedication to their sport than what she had, because not one person in that room had been anything other than encouraged, you know, throughout their time. Yes, you can play the game a little bit. Here's the next opportunity. Here's the next, you know, team that you can represent. Here's the next. And that's not saying all their journeys were easy, but in many cases they're extraordinarily difficult. But they'd never been mocked. You know, they'd never been, they're all aspects of who they were and their identity had been torn down just because of their love of the game. And the recognition and the representation of that, the fact that it took so long for Australian sport, and I suppose it deals on the whole of the importance of activism in terms of the feminist movement, all of these things, for Australian sport, and I'm talking all forms of sport, to have a serious conversation with women about the game. You can't have a serious conversation without providing at least the same career paths as what we have for the men. And we're a long way from that now, but we're getting there. And the role that you've played in regard to that, so that was 2007 to 2023, where the whole of the nation, you know, no one was doing anything. It's probably, you know, whatever television sets were turned on in this country at that time had the Matildas on them. everyone, even if you had not one iota of interest in the sport. And they're often, it's interesting, even in sort of the high achievement moments, they're often your quiet moments, I think, you know, almost where you can't express it to someone else, where you might sit back just quietly saying, yeah, I played a bit of a role in that. You know, but yeah, to actually say I played anything other than the bit of a role is almost, you know, taking too much credit, and there's a lot of people trying to take credit in those moments. It seems to me that that's been a story of your career in lots of ways, where there will be sort of like a Hakeem moment from time to time, but mostly the sense of achievement can only be felt by you, if you know what I mean. It's there's no silverware to run around the MCG. There's no $1 million landing in a bank account somewhere. There's none of that. But you've still remain driven to achieve in the context of that. Does that still drive you now, that sort of concept, do you think?
Well, I just wanted to live a principled life. And, you know, we haven't spoken about family. That's obviously most important, family and friends. But I've been fortunate to be able to communicate that through two things that I'm very passionate about, sport and labour and the rights of people. And so that's really the end game. And it's the process. It's both at the same time. You know, when it comes to some of the specifics, you know, I'm disappointed in the state of the A-Leagues right now. What changed for me probably during COVID was, you know what, this job's never done. You're not going to finish it. Early on, I thought we'd finish it. We would eliminate injustice. I understand that that was pretty naive now. So all you can do, it's a cliche, is not leave it better, but leave people, you know, motivated to carry it forward. You know, my role with the Matildas was a modest one. But we opened the door for exceptional leadership to be demonstrated, and we created that platform. And that's the real enabler, I think. You know, that group, you know, hearing them talk about the confidence they have in the Players Association, how important that is for them being who they are as a team. And that's accepted by management. You know, the game is proud of that now. Whereas back in the day, you know, it was a war zone. And so that's certainly pleasing, and it makes me, I wouldn't say comfortable, but it makes me cautiously optimistic that there's a platform.
We haven't spoken about family that much, and there's a couple of things that come to mind as you're speaking. You might remember in our we shared a bedroom for most of our childhood, and one of those things that Dad brought home in 1972 was a big map of England, which had all the teams on it. Can you remember?
Mm-hmm.
It was up on there. And so that was used to be beside my bed, like, you know, seemed massive at the time. And I used to try and see how many teams I could remember, and I couldn't believe there were so many teams because there was only 12 teams in the VFL and all that sort of stuff at the time. Second thing I can remember is the players coming round to our place to watch the FA Cup final. And I didn't have a huge interest in the game, but I had a big interest in the fact that, you know, Roy Sutton, Barry Richardson or Kevin Sheedy or whatever was, because it would be coming on at whatever time of night, and we'd be there in our pyjamas, you know, trying to stay up long enough to watch it. But then I remember the thing which stays in my mind is there was a game called Sabudio, is that what it's called? And you used to sit there and you could play that game for hours on your own, like just on your own, you know? And I think of that, and then, you know, the fact that, you know, you talked before about the, you know, that you can do that, you know, you can spend, and for so many people that would be seen as, you know, that sort of capacity just to do your own thing. And to take that sort of mindset into a world where you've actually had to collectively create a vision for something, which was such that people could see their role in it. and know that not one of them was going to play the major role, but they're all going to be role players in the context of it. And I think of that as like just that we all can find our own sort of way of leading, you know, which is, and you found your expression of your leadership just at such a young age, and perhaps I did as well, but I don't think I found my personal expression the way I did. I found it in the context of something else, but you had to form it and create it and almost build the institutions around you to in fact fulfill it. I just operated inside institutions in so many ways. And unbelievably proud of you, Brent, and what you've been able to achieve. I thank you for the opportunity of having a chat today, and as the two of us now get on with the rest of our lives.
Thanks, Cam.
Thanks, Brent.